Says my mom won't want it, and will be happy for your mother, and figures she deserves it, particularly after they cheated her out of her rightful mother. Let's see what our moms work out between them over that. Is the jewelry worth a great deal? According to our estimate, 20 to 30 million, before estate taxes, of course, which will cut that amount in half. But it was still an impressive amount. Penny whistled. That's a nice chunk of change. It could leave Valerie with $10 to $15 million after taxes. She'd be set for life, even more so than with her late husband's insurance. This really is an amazing story. It feels like the hand of destiny is on this one. One forgets that good things do happen to good people, not just bad ones. This would be nice for your mom. Yes, it would, Philip agreed. And for him one day. But he wasn't thinking about that. Well, let's get started. I'll send someone up to see the old nanny tomorrow. Shoot me an email with her details. You ask your mom about the DNA test and have her call me. And I'll prepare an order to exhume Marguerite's body. It's all less complicated than it sounds. And if there's no opposition to her being the rightful heir, there's no problem. At least the end of the story would be simpler and happier than the beginning, and hopefully with a good result for his mother, which was some consolation, although the jewelry and proceeds from it were no substitute for a mother. It was 7:30 when Philip left his cousin's office, and he called his mother as soon as he got home. She was painting. He told her what Penny had said, and she rapidly agreed to the DNA test and gave him Fiona's address at the nursing home in New Hampshire and said she'd call and warn her that someone would be coming to take a statement from her. When Valerie called Fiona, she said she would be happy to tell the story to the investigator when he arrived. Valerie was excited now to get the result of the DNA test. She was planning to call her doctor about it the next day. She seemed to have a deep, visceral need now to prove that Marguerite had been her mother, which no one was denying. At least not now. Not anymore. But she wanted to confirm it officially, as though to prove to herself that she'd had a mother who loved her after all. Finally, Valerie called Winnie. She just wanted to let her know what she was doing. Winnie listened carefully to what Valerie told her and sounded somewhat jangled when she responded.
"It's all so messy," she said, sounding unhappy. "Exhuming bodies, DNA tests... I wish we could just let it lie."
But then Marguerite's estate would go to the state, which seemed wrong to her, too. But she hated all the mess and facing the reality that her parents had been liars. She wasn't angry at Valerie anymore. She just wished that none of it had ever happened, or they hadn't found out. She was a little annoyed at Fiona for telling Valerie the story. Winnie had preferred to be an ostrich all her life, and so had her parents. And it was painful for Winnie to admit they were liars.
"I know you think I'm doing this for the money," Valerie said sadly, "but as hard as it is to believe, I'm not. I just want to prove she was my mother. I never felt as though I had one. Now I do."
It was too late for it to change anything, and it seemed childish of her to Winnie, and she had had parents after all, even if they weren't her real ones. But she could hear how much it meant to Valerie, and there was no stopping the process now. Pandora's box had been opened.
"And you have a right to a share of the jewelry, too," Valerie told her. "She was your sister."
"I don't want anything from her estate," Edwina said firmly. "Henry left me more than enough. I wouldn't know what to do with it, and his parents took care of Penny. She has all she'll ever need, and so will her children. I've set up generation-skipping trusts for them. Just worry about you and Philip. If she really was your mother, that's only right."
Winnie was not an easy person, or a particularly happy one, but she was honest and fair, and had no intention of fighting with Valerie over the estate, or even expecting part of it.
"If I turn out to be your aunt, and not your sister, you can take me to dinner," Winnie said with a wintry smile.
"If you want, I'll take you to Europe," Valerie promised. "I want to see where she lived. Philip just went to visit the chateau in Naples."
Valerie sounded wistful as she said it.
"I always get sick in Italy," Winnie complained. "The food is too rich. The last time it gave me diverticulitis," she said,
and Valerie laughed.
"Well, think about it."
"You can take pictures for me,"
Winnie said firmly, as Valerie admitted to herself silently that it would be easier traveling without her,
but she was grateful, too, that Winnie planned to make no opposition to the estate and wanted nothing from it. It would make the process simpler. The next day, Valerie went to get the DNA test. Penny filed a request with the state to exhume the body and get a DNA test of Marguerite, and she sent a licensed investigator to interview Fiona in New Hampshire. They were on their way, and Jane was in Harriet's office that morning as soon as she arrived. "We have an heir to the Pignelli estate," she said, looking excited, as Harriet's eyes widened. "Someone answered the ad?" Harriet seemed startled, but pleased. "It's a lot more complicated than that," Jane shared with her, and told her the whole story in detail, as Harriet listened in amazement. The form came across her desk 2 days later, requesting to exhume Marguerite's body for a DNA match, and she submitted it to the court immediately to facilitate the process. And as Jane left her office, she couldn't help thinking that if she had gotten the clerkship she wanted in family law, and not at the surrogate's court, she would never have met Philip, and his mother might never have discovered the truth about her own history. He had invited Jane to dinner that weekend, and to visit his boat when the weather got warmer. It gave her something to look forward to. Her life was looking up these days, and all thanks to Marguerite Pearson di San Pignelli and the jewelry she had left in her abandoned safe deposit box. It was beginning to feel like a miracle to all of them. When Philip got the letters from Jane, he brought his mother a set the same night. She would get the originals eventually, but he knew she would want to read them right away and not on a screen. He explained to her quietly what they were, and she started to cry even before she took them out of the manila envelope he had put them in. And she told him she wanted to read them alone, after she thanked him for bringing them to her. She suspected they would be painful, but she had no idea how excruciatingly poignant it would be to read of her mother's decades of suffering and never-ending sense of loss, having given up her baby daughter only to grieve for her entire life. Valerie sobbed for hours as she went through them intently and went over them again, but when she had finished, she knew exactly how loved she had been. She wished that her mother had dared to approach her when she was 18, instead of fearing it would ruin her life. It wouldn't have. It would have improved it immeasurably to meet the mother who loved her instead of the one she had. And she wished that Marguerite had contacted her over the years, or when she moved back to New York 22 years before. At any point in her life, Valerie would have welcomed her with open arms, and now she would never have that chance. But now at least she knew who she had lost, the woman she had been, and the love her mother had had for her. Knowing that put balm on some very old wounds of never having had a mother's love, except from her nanny Fiona until she was 10. She had never had maternal love from the woman who had pretended to be her mother, her own grandmother, who had taken her just to avoid the scandal, and not from any deep feelings for her, of which she had none. If anything, she had resented Valerie all her life for how she'd been conceived, and she had thrown away her own daughter while stealing hers from her. 2 daughters had been lost, not just one. It remained inconceivable to Valerie, and yet it had all happened, and all she wished, as she finished reading the letters, was that she could have held her mother once, so they could tell each other how much they loved each other. Valerie would have given anything for that, but the letters would have to be enough, and they were an amazing gift, from the mother she had never known. She realized now in every fiber of her being that Marguerite had always loved her with all her heart and soul. Chapter 16. The night after Valerie had her blood drawn for the DNA test, she was painting in her studio, and the figure she'd been working on of the unknown woman had begun to look more and more like the photographs of Marguerite. There was an eerie, wistful quality to it, like a mystery emerging from the mists. There was something sad about the painting, and Fiona's words about her natural mother and father kept echoing in Valerie's head, that they had been like Romeo and Juliet. Fiona had said that Tommy's parents had been as upset as Marguerite's about the pregnancy, so they couldn't have harbored warm feelings for her either, as the tangible result of their son's foolishness. And even when he died, they must have not wanted his child, or they would have reached out in some way, and they never did, not that she knew, although maybe her grandparents had concealed that too. And by now, she was sure that her paternal grandparents would be dead. They would have been over 100 years old, like her own. But she couldn't help wondering if some other member of the family had survived. Given how soon he died after Valerie was conceived, Tommy would have had no other children, but perhaps he had siblings or cousins. She had a thirst for her relatives now that nothing could quench. She wanted to know it all. She had half of the equation. Now she wanted the rest. She set down her brushes and left her studio to sit at her computer at her desk, and she put Tommy and his parents' names into a search engine. She Googled them in different ways, using Tommy's birth date and a guess at when he was killed. Thomas, Muriel, and Fred Babcock. Eventually, the information came up that they were deceased. Then she tried Thomas Babcock, thinking that a relative might have named a child after her father, since he died during the war. She found one in New York who was 10 years younger than she was, which might have been about right if Tommy had a brother who had named a child after him. Feeling her heart pound in her chest, with a shaking hand, Valerie called the phone number on her cell phone and held her breath while it rang. It would be just too incredible if she got it right on the first try, but the possibility of it was exciting. She'd heard stories like this before, of people seeking long-lost parents, often who had put them up for adoption, and as the result of a random call, they were united via the Internet. She had become one of them, children born out of wedlock, looking for their roots, compelled to find their parents or relatives, trying to gather up the fragments of a lost life before it was too late. Or was it already too late? Were all of Tommy's relatives dead? Had he been an only child? A man answered on the third ring. He had a pleasant voice, and Valerie launched nervously into her story about Tommy Babcock and her mother 75 years before. Separated young lovers, an unwanted pregnancy, and his untimely death in the early weeks of the war. It sounded like a strange story even to her, as she described it. The man at the other end of the phone was silent as he listened.
"Did you have an uncle or a relative named Thomas Babcock?" she asked hopefully, and waited anxiously for his answer.
"Yes, I did," he said, "but I don't think he's the one you're looking for. I had an Uncle Tom, and my grandfather was named Thomas, too. I don't think my uncle's your man, though," he said, chuckling.
"Why not?"
Valerie asked, curious, and wondering if he actually was the right one. So many coincidences that had seemed wrong at first had proved to be true.
"My uncle was gay. He was an early activist in gay rights and moved to San Francisco in the 60s. He was a great guy, and he died of AIDS in 1982. I don't think he fathered any babies. He was a very talented set designer on Broadway and became a well-known interior designer in San Francisco."
His nephew sounded proud of him, but this clearly wasn't who she was looking for.
"I hope you find some relative of your father's. It sounds like a sad story. Why did you wait so long to look for his family?"
"I only discovered the true story recently myself. In those days, babies born out of wedlock were pretty shocking, and no one talked about it."
"I guess that's true," he said kindly. "Well, good luck."
They hung up a moment later, while Valerie wondered how many wrong Babcocks she'd have to call, and if she'd ever find the right one, who'd been somehow related to her father. She tried the same name again, and dozens came up, some as young as 4 years old, from a variety of states. And finally one of them struck her as possible again. He was 70 years old, born the year after the war ended, and he lived in Santa Barbara, California, with his wife Angela, and a Walter Babcock, who was 94 years old. The possible fantasy struck her immediately. What if Tommy had had an older brother who married and had a son after the war and named him after his deceased brother? She believed that anything was possible now. She would have liked to call Fiona to ask her, but it was too late. She would be sound asleep. Valerie sat staring at the names and number, desperate to call. She no longer cared if people thought she was crazy. She picked up the phone and called. It was only 7 o'clock at night in California, and the worst they could say was that she had the wrong number and hang up. She had already decided to ask for Thomas Babcock, and not his father. Thomas would have been the nephew of her natural father, if she guessed right. A woman answered in a slight southern accent when Valerie asked to speak to Thomas Babcock and closed her eyes as she waited. She had nothing to lose except time and face, and she didn't mind losing either one. A moment later, a man with a deep, vibrant voice came on the line. He didn't seem upset to be called by a stranger, and she explained rapidly and as clearly as possible the reason for her call.
"I know this must sound crazy, but I was born in June 1942, out of wedlock, to a young woman named Marguerite Wallace Pearson and a boy named Tommy Babcock. His parents were Muriel and Fred. My mother and father were 17 years old when I was conceived, in New York. My mother was sent to Maine to have me in secret. My father went into the army right after Pearl Harbor and was killed in an accident in January 1942 in California, before I was born. My grandparents brought me up and claimed me as their own. They sent my mother away to Europe after I was born, and I never saw her again. I learned all of this very recently, and never knew anything about either of my parents till now. I just located my mother, unfortunately, 6 months after she died. And now that I know something about him, I was wondering if some members of my father's family were still alive. Maybe they knew the story of my parents and remember it. I was wondering if your father, Walter, had a brother who matches this description and died in the war."
She fell silent then. Thomas Babcock had kindly and politely listened to her entire recital, even if he was the wrong one. Something about the way she told the story and the impact of it touched his heart. She sounded like a rational woman, and it moved him that she was searching for her parents at 74. His assumption, though not correct, was that she must have an empty life, and he would like to help if he could.
"Actually," he said, sounding very kind, "I was named after an uncle who did in fact die during the war at just that time. He was only 18, but he didn't have any children. He was my father's younger brother, and they were very close growing up, almost like twins, from what he says. He still cries when he talks about him, and he's 94. I'd let you talk to him, but he's very frail now. He goes to bed early, and he's asleep."
"Is it possible that he wouldn't have known about an unwanted pregnancy, or wouldn't have told you about it, not to sully the memory of a beloved younger brother?"
The man on the other end laughed in answer.
"It's possible, but not likely. My dad is a pretty straight-shooting guy, and can be bawdy at times. I think he would have told me if he knew, or if something like that had happened. But I can certainly ask. Why don't you leave me your name and number, and I'll talk to him tomorrow, and get back to you if I turn up anything."
"Thank you," she said, grateful and relieved. "I know this must sound stupid, and I don't know why this matters to me at my age, but it does. I think without knowing it, I've been looking for them all my life."
"We all need to know our roots," Tom Babcock said sympathetically.
She gave him her name and number, and he said he'd call her either way, and then they hung up.
"Who was that?"
his wife Angie asked him as she finished cleaning up the dishes from their dinner. They lived in Montecito in Santa Barbara, and Tom's father was living with them. He was in a wheelchair now, but they didn't want to put him in a nursing home. They had agreed that he would stay with them till the end. They had 4 grown children and 6 grandchildren, and they wanted to set the example that elderly parents weren't to be discarded like old shoes, but were to be cherished and respected, even when it was inconvenient and sometimes hard. And he was a sweet old man, though he had been failing rapidly for the last year.
"It was some woman in New York who was older than I am, and says she's the illegitimate daughter of a man named Tommy Babcock, who died during the war at 18, and a young teenage girl he was in love with. She's only just learned about them. Her mother's already dead, and she's trying to find relatives of his. I don't think we're it. I promised her I'd ask Dad, but he'd have told me something like that. He's never been one to keep secrets," Tom said, as he put an arm around her, and she agreed. Angie was from South Carolina, and they had been married for 43 years, happily so. His father had settled in California, in La Jolla, after being stationed in San Diego after the war. And Tom had been born there and lived in California all his life, although his parents were originally from New York. He and Angie had met at UC San Diego,
married right after graduation, moved to Santa Barbara, and had been there ever since. And their adult children lived in Santa Barbara and L.A., and they saw a lot of them. Tom was an architect and still active in his field. He always said retirement wasn't for him, and his father had run a successful business and retired at 83. Angie was an interior designer and frequently worked with Tom. They were happy, busy, and fulfilled, and still involved in their careers, and the kids were doing well. They had many friends, and they were friendly, loving people. Tom's warmth and kindness had come across on the phone, which had given Valerie the courage to tell the story, although he didn't appear to be the right one. And it had taken so much energy to call him that she didn't call any of the other Thomas Babcocks after that, and went to bed. The next morning, after he helped his father shower and shave, and got him dressed and into his wheelchair, Tom told him about the call the night before. "Some woman from New York called here last night, looking for you, Dad." His son teased him a little. He hadn't lost his sense of humor yet. "She said she heard you were a handsome guy." Walter Babcock guffawed and didn't believe a word of it, and then his son explained the reason for her call. "She said that her parents were a couple of 17-year-olds in New York in 1941. Her mom got pregnant with her and was sent away to have the baby, and I think her grandparents brought her up, and they never let her see her mother. She never even knew about her till now. She said her dad was killed in an accident right after he was drafted in January 1942, before she was born, when he was just 18. She only just learned about all of it. She found her mother, but she'd already died, and now she's looking for her father's relatives to touch base with her roots and meet them. She sounded like a nice person, and she's 74 years old, so she's no kid. The story sounded like Uncle Tommy, except you never told me about a baby. She said her mother's name was Margaret Pearson, something like that. It was close enough. Maybe you didn't know?" Tom asked his father casually, and his father looked agitated and sounded angry.
"I would have known if he got some girl pregnant. Tommy would never have done a thing like that. Of course it's not him. What's wrong with that woman, at her age, throwing dirt at the reputation of people who've been dead for 74 years? She should be ashamed of herself. I hope you don't talk to her again."
He was frowning in his wheelchair and looked fierce, and his son had started his day off on the wrong foot. He still considered his brother's memory sacred, and was furious at what she'd said and tried to do.
"I told her I'd call her either way," Tom said easily. "She sounded serious about it. It must be sad not to know who your parents are until you're 74 years old, and never have met either one."
"At her age, she shouldn't care. Doesn't she have kids?"
"I didn't ask," Tom said honestly. "Maybe not, but even if she does, you read stories like this all the time, or see them on TV, of 80-year-old people looking for their 100-year-old mothers who put them up for adoption. I think those things haunt people forever. I'm glad it wasn't Uncle Tommy. It must be terrible for that poor woman to have never known her parents."
He hadn't known his uncle either, but his father had talked about him all his life. He had never fully gotten over his younger brother's death. Tom rolled his father into the kitchen for his breakfast then, and their housekeeper and a male attendant arrived to take care of him. They never left him alone. And then he and Angie left for work together. Tom called Valerie from his architectural office and told her about the conversation with his father.
"I'm really sorry, Mrs. Lawton. I would have loved to come up with some relatives for you. It's a touching story, and I hope you find the right people. I'm afraid I came up dry out here."
He didn't tell her that his father had been outraged by the story, which he himself had found heart-wrenching. "Thank you so much for trying," Valerie said pleasantly, grateful that he had spoken to his father, and even called her back, and didn't dismiss her as a lunatic. But stranger things had happened. It might have worked, and been the right Babcock. "I knew it was a long shot. It was really a stab in the dark. I don't know where to go from here." Although there were many more Thomas Babcock she hadn't tried.
"Maybe a detective agency, if it's worth it to you," he suggested.
"I'd never thought of that," she admitted. "But this is all very new to me, the search for lost parents. I always thought I knew who mine were. It turns out I didn't.
Well, good luck, Tom said, and they hung up. Andy forgot about it.
And for the next 3 days, the housekeeper and male nurse said Walter had been impossible, cantankerous, difficult, in a bad mood, restless, and he had hardly eaten.
And when Tom walked into his father's room when he came home from work at the end of the 3 days, he found his father crying, which frightened Tom. He had never seen him that way, and his father turned to him with tears rolling down his cheeks.
"What's up, Dad? Are you feeling sick? Do you want me to call the doctor? Joe and Carmen said you're not eating."
And he had rejected Angie's dinner, too, the night before.
"It's that woman," he said in a choked voice.
"What woman? Carmen?"
The housekeeper had been with them since their kids were young, and she had always been kind to him.
"Has she been giving you a hard time?"
"No."
He shook his head miserably and looked like he had shrunk in the past few days.
"The one who called you and told those lies about Tommy. Why would you do a thing like that? He was such a good boy."
He was genuinely frantic about it, and Tom was worried it might be an early sign of dementia, although he'd had none before. But he was desperately upset and agitated.
"Of course he was, Dad."
Tom tried to soothe him, but his father was inconsolable over what he considered the insult to his late baby brother, whom he revered as a saint.
"She's just looking for her father's family. You can't blame her for that. She didn't mean any harm by it."
"He never got anyone knocked up,"
Walter insisted, and continued crying.
"She just got us off the internet, Dad. She never knew Uncle Tommy."
"She's as bad as her mother was,"
he suddenly said fiercely, in a tone his son had never heard him use before.
"I never liked her. She just wanted to trap Tommy, and she got what she deserved. They sent her off to some prison camp for bad girls in New England somewhere. My parents never let Tommy see her again. He thought he was in love with her. He even wanted to marry her, but Dad wouldn't let him. And then he was killed. I don't know what happened to her. It didn't matter after that."
He was crying harder as Tom stared at him.
"You knew her?"
His father wouldn't answer him and looked out the window with tears streaming down his cheeks.
"He hardly talked to me once he fell in love with her. She put a spell on him. He said he was going to marry her."
It was obvious to Tom that his father had been jealous of her and the love the two young people had shared. And it sounded like they'd paid a high price for it, separated from each other, punished by their parents, the baby taken from the young girl by her own parents, never to be seen again, and the boy she loved killed while she was pregnant with his baby. He could only feel sorry for her while his father was still angry and jealous of her and had lied to his son about it to protect his brother's memory.
"Dad, why didn't you tell me? These things happen, especially in those days. It must have been a terrible scandal back then,"
Tom said sympathetically.
"It would have been. Our parents never let that happen. They covered it up immediately, and so did her parents. No one wanted that baby. I don't know what happened to it, but it got what it deserved, and so did its mother. Marguerite. I hated her."
"I think that was the baby I was talking to on the phone the other night. And I don't agree with you about her getting what she deserved. What did she do to deserve that? 75 years later, she's still looking for her parents and trying to figure out who they are. That doesn't seem fair to me, because two teenage kids fell in love with each other. Come on, Dad. You're her uncle. And what if she's a nice person? Is this what Tommy would want you to do to the girl he loved or their baby? What if it were your child and you'd been killed? Would he pretend he knew nothing about her and ignore her? I'm ashamed of you, Dad. You're bigger than that. At least we can tell her she found her father's family. I'm sure she's not going to ask you for money."
Tom smiled at him, trying to lighten the moment.
"How do you know? The Pearsons were pretty fancy, although they lost most of their money in the Depression. They thought they were better than everyone. Then look what happened. Their precious daughter got knocked up. Our mother was ready to kill her. She forbade Tommy to ever see her again. He cried all night over it, and then her parents sent her away the next day. I think he went to see her once at the home, and then he got sent to California and died right after that.
Tom had never heard his father so harsh, and the whole story sounded like a nightmare, especially for both young people, who had been treated like criminals by their parents. Tom felt sorry for both of them, but clearly Valerie had touched a nerve with this story. His father hadn't recovered from it yet.
"I don't want anything to do with her!"
Walter barked at him, and Tom quietly left the room a few minutes later to let him calm down, and he went to tell Angie what had happened. She was stunned, too. Walter had lied to protect the memory of his brother, and had no regrets about it.
"What are you going to do?"
Angie asked him as they shared a quiet dinner in the kitchen that night, after his father went to sleep. He had finally calmed down a little after he'd vented about it, and Tom didn't bring it up again.
"I'm going to find her number and call her tomorrow, when I get to the office. I hope I didn't throw it away, and I'm going to tell her Dad lied to me. He's never done that before."
"You know how sensitive he is about his brother,"
Angie said gently, but Tom looked shocked and disappointed.
"Can you imagine what a nightmare that must have been for those two kids, especially in those days? And look at it. She never saw her mother or even knew who she was, or her father. And who knows, maybe if he'd lived, Uncle Tommy might have married her and she'd be our Aunt Marguerite."
Remembering his father had corrected him about the name.
"Instead, she was an outcast, and their child was a lost soul."
"It's a terrible story," he said, profoundly upset by it. And as he said he would, he called Valerie first thing the next morning when he found the paper still on his desk with her number on it. She was painting when he called, squinting at the portrait of Marguerite. It was noon in New York on a blustery March day, and she didn't recognize the voice when she answered.
"Mrs. Lawton?" he asked cautiously.
"Yes."
"Tom Babcock, we spoke the other night about my uncle and my father."
She knew who he was the moment he said the name.
"Of course. I didn't recognize your voice at first."
She smiled as she said it.
"You're so nice to call me back. I'm really sorry I troubled you. I was just hoping you were the right one."
She sounded faintly embarrassed in the clear light of day, since his father hadn't known anything about it and hadn't known her mother.
"I owe you an apology,"
Tom said bluntly, with sincere regret in his voice.
"My father lied to me. He's never done that before. I don't know what to say except how sorry I am. I didn't mean to mislead you. My father did know your mother, and he knew the story. He just didn't know what happened to the baby, and I guess no one ever talked about it in those days. It must have been a terrible time for your mother and my uncle."
"Oh, my God."
She sounded like she had just won the lottery.
"Your father is Tommy Babcock's brother? He's my uncle?"
There were tears in her eyes, and in Tom Babcock's. She was clearly so moved that it touched him, too.
"And I'm your cousin. I don't know if it's a blessing for you or not, or something to celebrate, but you found the family you were looking for. And I'm so sorry my father misled me,"
he said again.
"He revered his brother, and I don't think he ever got over losing him. The idea of besmirching his memory over an unwanted pregnancy was just too much for him."
"I understand. It was a big deal then. The poor kids must have been desperate. It's hard to imagine. And then your uncle died, and my mom must have been even more lost. Her parents banished her forever after I was born, and pretended she was dead. They sent her to Europe during the war at 18 and never saw her again. And my grandparents pretended I was their child. That's pretty heavy stuff."
"It certainly is. I'm sorry you never knew her."
"So am I," Valerie said sadly. "I have some photographs of her now. I just got them recently and know more about her life. She never had other children, just me."
"Do you have children?"
Tom asked, curious about her, now that they were related.
"One. A son named Philip. He's wonderful. He's 34 and works at the auction house Christie's, in the jewelry department. He has a master's in art history. His father was an art history professor, and I'm an artist, a painter.
I'm an architect, and my wife is an interior designer, and we have 4 grown kids, 6 grandchildren.
They were suddenly a family, and they were both excited, and Valerie sounded shy when she asked the next question. Do you suppose we could ever meet?
Of course, he said kindly. We're first cousins.
Your father wouldn't have to see me if it would upset him. He was very old, and she didn't want to give him a heart attack or kill him.
I would expect nothing less of him, Tom said firmly. I'm sure his sainted brother would have seen his daughter if the situation were reversed, if everything Dad says about him is true, about what a great guy he was, although he was just a kid. It's sad to think of my uncle dying at 18.
Valerie agreed. If it's not inconvenient, maybe I could come out in the next couple of weeks.
He didn't know what her circumstances were, and if she'd expect to stay with them, which would be hard with a total stranger, even if they were long-lost cousins.
I could stay at the Biltmore, she said quickly. I've stayed there before.
I'll talk to my wife and we'll arrange it, he promised. And Valerie, he said in a gentle tone, I'm glad you found us.
So am I, she said as tears rolled down her cheeks.
It wasn't exactly like finding her father, but it was close enough. She could hardly wait to meet them, and was excited when she hung up. She was waiting for the results of the DNA test to make it official, but she knew in her heart what the results would be, and it was important to her to find her father's family too, if she could. She heard from Angie 2 days later, and they agreed on a weekend that worked for both of them. It was 10 days away. Valerie could hardly wait to meet the family she had never known, and they could only be 1,000 times better than the one she had growing up.
Chapter 17. The following week, when Philip called her, Valerie casually mentioned that she was going to California for the weekend, and he was surprised.
What are you doing out there, some kind of art show?
No, I'm going to visit my cousins, she said, with mischief in her voice. She had been in great spirits ever since she'd found them.
What cousins? We don't have cousins in California.
The only cousin he had was Penny. We do now. I got busy on the internet one night. I was trying to find relatives of my father's. I tried some different combinations, and I got lucky on the second shot. I found his older brother and my father's nephew. His father denied it at first because of the disgrace at the time, and he was trying to protect his brother. And then his son called me back when he realized that Tommy's brother had lied about it. And now I'm going out there to meet them.
She sounded like a kid at Christmas.
Are they good people?
Philip was worried. He didn't want anyone being unkind to her. He thought she was being a little naive, particularly if her father's brother had initially been dishonest and hostile.
They seem like it. Tom, my cousin, is an architect married to a very nice woman. I talked to her. She is an interior designer. They have 4 grown kids. They live in Santa Barbara, and they have grandchildren. Tom's 65, and she's a few years younger. Walter, my father's brother, is 94, and apparently very frail.
She knew all about them, and until now he had heard nothing about it.
Well, you've certainly been busy. Do you need me to come with you?
He had plans that weekend, but would have gone with her if she'd asked. He didn't love the idea of her facing these people alone, but she had no qualms about it.
Of course not. I'll be fine, but thanks for asking. I'm just staying the weekend. I have a busy week next week with a board meeting at the Met.
Well, call me from out there. Where are you staying?
At the Biltmore.
She made it sound like an adventure, and Philip was smiling to himself when he hung up. He told Jane about it at dinner that night. It was their second date. He had taken her to dinner and a movie the week before, and it had gone well. And they were planning to spend the day together on his boat that weekend. Jane was looking forward to it. She was touched when she heard about Valerie's plans to fly to California to meet her father's relatives. It seemed very brave of her, and she said as much to Philip.
This seems to mean a lot to her. I think she felt like such an outsider growing up and so disapproved of that she's hungry now to meet the relative she never knew she had, if that makes sense.
It does, but knowing what we do now about her background, it must have been so hard for her as a kid.
I don't think it was easy. She's very different from her sister and the grandparents who pretended to be her parents. She's a much warmer person. Her mother must have been more like her. It's a shame she never knew her, he said sympathetically. And then he added, I'd like you to meet my mother sometime. Jane looked pleased by the suggestion. I have to meet Sweet Sally first, she said, referring to his boat, and Philip grinned. You have to be aware that she will always be my first love. She's been the woman in my life till now. Believe me, I get it. My father would give up our whole family to keep his boat. You don't try to come between a man and his sailboat. Then everything should be just fine, he said, pleased. They'd had a nice time so far going out to dinner, and he'd gotten a glimpse of her small, cheerful apartment when he picked her up for their second date. She had made magic with the things she'd bought at IKEA, and it turned it into a cozy home, and she'd only been there a short time. It was the kind of thing his mother would have done. They talked a little over dinner about the DNA results they were waiting for. The order to exhume Marguerite's body and perform the DNA test had been approved and signed by the judge the week before, and they had another 5 weeks to wait for the results, but there seemed to be no doubt in anyone's mind now what they would be. It was clear from everything Fiona had told her that Marguerite was her mother. And Jane commented that she would have left the surrogate's court by the time the results came in. She had to attend 2 more months of classes, and then she was due to graduate from law school in June. "And what are you going to do after you graduate?" he asked her over dinner. "Pass the bar and get a job at a law firm." She had resumes out at several top firms but hadn't heard anything conclusive yet, and she would have to focus on review for the bar exam soon. "And I want to go home to Michigan for a couple of weeks to see my parents before I start work." It sounded reasonable to him. The time he spent with her sped by as they talked about a variety of subjects and got to know each other better. He had never met a woman as easy to be with. Everything felt simple and natural when he was with her, and he had a feeling that his mother was going to like her too. The real test came when he drove her to Long Island that weekend. He picked her up at her apartment at 9 in the morning and was relieved to see that she was wearing jeans, a warm jacket, and sneakers. The last girl he had invited to the boat had showed up wearing a miniskirt and high heels, and he was even more impressed when she helped him with the sails and slipping the moorings. Her father had taught her well, and she knew exactly what to do. He had brought a picnic lunch for them, and he threw the anchor in a small cove where there was shelter, bright sun, and a gentle breeze. "This is perfect," she said, smiling at him, obviously enjoying the day as much as he was. There was something about being on a sailboat that allowed you to forget all your worries and just enjoy the wind and the sea. They stretched out on the deck in the sun afterward. It was still too cold to go swimming, and as she lay there with her eyes closed, enjoying the warmth of the sun, he leaned over and kissed her, and she slipped her arms around his neck and smiled at him. Neither of them said a word, but just enjoyed the moment, and then he rolled over on his side next to her and propped himself up on one elbow. "How did I get so lucky?" he said happily. "I thought I was just going to do some boring appraisal, and instead I found you." Philip felt like it was meant to be. She felt the same way about him. And she was well aware that she could have still been miserable with John if she hadn't had the guts to leave him. She was glad now that she had, and hadn't let it drag on till June. "You just like me because I'm a halfway decent sailor," she teased him, and he grinned. "Yeah, that too. I like you because you're smart and kind and a good person, not to mention beautiful." He kissed her again then, and he lay holding her for a long time, but they went no further. They both knew it was too soon and didn't want to rush things. They wanted to savor the beginning and see where it went. There was no hurry. And a little while later, they set sail again and enjoyed the afternoon on Sweet Sally. They were tired and relaxed when they finally sailed back toward the dock, and she helped him tie the boat up, and they walked to his car hand in hand. "Thank you for such a nice day," she said, and he could see that she meant it. It had been a perfect day for both of them. They cooked dinner together at her apartment that night and watched a movie. They sat close to each other, and he kissed her. It was after midnight when he left, promising to call her the next day. She had already agreed to go back to the boat with him the next weekend. She was beginning to look like the perfect woman to him. Chapter 18. Before Valerie left for California for the weekend, she called Winnie to tell her she was going out of town. She always tried to check in with her, in case Winnie needed anything. Valerie liked to let her know her plans, and then she could call Penny or someone else, like her housekeeper, if she needed help with anything.
"Where are you going?"
Winnie asked her, sounding suspicious.
"To California," Valerie said vaguely. She wasn't sure if she wanted to tell her who she was visiting or why.
"What are you doing there?"
"I'm going to Santa Barbara to see friends."
"That's an awfully long way to go for the weekend."
Winnie hated going anywhere and said she liked sleeping in her own bed. She had never been very adventuresome, even when she was young.
"What friends do you have in Santa Barbara?"
She couldn't recall Valerie ever mentioning them, and of course she was right. She looked years older than Valerie and acted it, but her memory was still acute. Valerie decided then that there was no escaping it and told her who she was going to see.
"You found them on the internet? Are you crazy? What if they're axe murderers or awful people?"
"Then I won't see them again. I'm staying at a hotel, the Biltmore, if you want to reach me. And they might have the same concerns about me. They don't know me from Adam. I called them out of the blue with my story. They were extremely nice about it. I just want to meet them and see how it feels."
She was acquiring new relatives and a whole new life.
"Why do you need them now, at your age? What difference will it make?"
She was finding the whole thing unsettling. First, Valerie's horrifying discoveries about Marguerite, and then her insistence on the DNA test. It had been her own daughter's idea, and Winnie wasn't pleased about that either. And now she was going to meet her alleged father's family, who might turn out to be dreadful people. Why couldn't she just let the dead rest? It was all so upsetting.
"I'm not sure," Valerie answered her honestly. "I just feel it's something I have to do. That boy was my father, and this is his family. I want to meet them and see if I feel any kind of connection to them. I never felt any with the people I thought were my parents and were my grandparents."
"And you think you'll feel connected to an uncle and a cousin you've never met? What could you possibly have in common with them?"
"I don't know. That's what I want to find out."
She was on a mission, and the trip was a pilgrimage of sorts to honor the past. She hadn't told Winnie about her mother's letters. She felt tender and protective of them, and Winnie always had something negative to say about everything. But the Babcock connection seemed less private to her, and she was willing to share that.
"You might not have felt any connection to your biological father either. They were just kids."
But the Babcocks were her family, whatever Winnie thought.
"Be careful, Valerie. Take care of yourself."
"I will. Don't worry, I'll be fine."
Winnie grumbled a grudging goodbye, and Valerie left for the airport a few minutes later. She felt carefree and young, about to discover another part of her life, her history, and herself. And nothing about it felt wrong, despite Winnie's misgivings. She never trusted anyone or anything, which was part of her negative view of life, just like her mother's. They were so much alike, and more with time. Winnie had turned into her mother as she aged. Valerie couldn't imagine anything worse. The plane landed in Los Angeles on time, and she rented a car at the airport for the 2-hour drive to Santa Barbara. She was going to check into the hotel first and call them. Angie and Tom had invited her to dinner. She was slightly nervous about meeting them as she drove north, but mostly excited about the discoveries they would make. It was late afternoon by the time Valerie got to the Biltmore and checked in. She took a walk for a few minutes through the Coral Casino, the swim club that was across the street from the hotel and owned by them. And then she went back to her room and called Tom to tell him she had arrived. He asked how the trip was, and she said it was fine, and she thought he sounded nervous too. This was emotional for all of them, especially his father, who had said he wouldn't meet her and would stay in his room when she came to the house. Tom wasn't going to force him to see Valerie, but he told his father he thought he was wrong.
"I'm not going to meet that girl's illegitimate baby. Why should I?"
"Because she's your brother's daughter and your niece," Tom said again, but his father just turned stone-faced and looked away.
Tom had offered to pick her up at the hotel, but Valerie insisted she could drive herself to their home, and she headed toward Montecito at 6 o'clock and followed the directions he had given her to their house. When she got there, she saw that it was a big, sprawling Spanish-style home with a wide circular driveway perched high on a hill with a beautiful view. The house was substantial and the grounds extensive, perfectly manicured and well-designed, and there was a large swimming pool and tennis courts off to the side. She walked up the front steps and rang the doorbell, and a moment later, the door opened and Angie appeared. She was an attractive blonde with a wide smile, and right behind her a tall man appeared, who looked like a teddy bear, and the only trait they seemed to have in common was the same snow-white hair. Without hesitating, Tom gave her a warm hug, and Angie kissed her hello. Valerie had worn a pale blue cashmere sweater and gray slacks and was carrying a blazer in the cool air, and wondered if she was too informal. Angie was wearing a dress and high heels, and Tom was wearing a shirt and tie and a suit in her honor. But the atmosphere in the house was informal, and they walked her through the beautifully decorated home to a patio with heaters outside, where they could enjoy the view. Angie told her they had bought and remodeled the house when the children were young, and it was a little too big for them now, but they loved it. And they had good living quarters for Tom's father, who was with them now. He had been living with them since Tom's mother died 10 years before. But Valerie saw no sign of Walter as they drank white wine and got to know each other. They seemed like warm, kind people and made her feel at home. And she was surprised by how at ease she was with them, as though they had known each other all their lives. They were that sort of people, with an easy California style, but Valerie felt something more. The conversation turned toward her being an artist, and Tom surprised her by saying her father had been a talented artist too, and that Walter had many of his drawings and some of his paintings. It explained where her own talent had come from, since no one else in her family had had any interest in art. It was one of the things that had drawn her to her husband when they met. They chatted for an hour before dinner, and then went inside. Angie had organized a beautiful table and meal, and the housekeeper had stayed to serve it. Valerie noticed that the dining room table had been set for three, and remembered that Tom had said his father went to bed early since he was so old. And Tom excused himself before dinner to go and check on him. He found his father in his bedroom, in his wheelchair, looking out the window and scowling. "Are you going to come and meet her, Dad? She's a lovely woman."
"No, I'm not."
"She's older than I am. She's not some kid or some hippie. You at least owe her that."
"I don't owe her a damn thing,"
he growled, and spun around to turn his back on his son, who quietly left the room. It was like dealing with a child. He had never seen his father behave like this, and didn't like it, and he knew that Valerie would be disappointed not to meet him after coming this far. Instead, as he walked back to the dining room, Tom picked up some framed photographs on the way, then showed them to Valerie. They were photographs of her father, as a boy and in his teens. There was one of him at the age he must have been when he was in love with her mother, and another of him in uniform right before he left New York for the West Coast. And she was struck immediately by the resemblance, not only to her, but to her son. Valerie looked far more like him than any of the Pearsons, and he was a very handsome young man. Tom was watching her intently as she looked at the photographs, and then back at him.
"You look a lot like your father," he said softly as they sat down to dinner.
Valerie nodded, thinking how remarkable it was that she had found them. She could have called all the wrong Thomas Babcocks, but she hadn't. She had honed in on the right one, on the second try, and now she was here.
"Does your father look like him, too?" she asked, curious about him.
"Not really. He looks more like me, although he's smaller now than he was. He's lost a lot of weight."
She nodded, wondering when she would meet Walter and how that would feel. They talked about a variety of subjects during dinner, music, art, theater. Angie said they went to L.A. often for cultural events, but they liked living in Montecito and having more space and better weather, and Tom's architectural practice had always been there. Tom said the children had loved growing up in Santa Barbara and only wanted moved to L.A. They talked about their children, and Valerie showed them a photograph of Philip. Tom commented on how much he looked like his grandfather, too. The Babcock genes had been strong in both Valerie and her son. And Angie proudly showed her photographs of their grandchildren, whom she adored. Valerie asked if they ever came to New York, and they said not often enough, but they were busy with work and their kids, and they didn't like leaving Tom's father for long periods of time. They were obviously dedicated to their family and responsible people, and Tom smiled at her at the end of dinner.
"I never had a sister, and I have no cousins. I like having a cousin now. I wish you'd found us sooner," he said warmly.
"So do I," she said, and meant it. "I didn't even know you existed, or about any of this, until very recently. It all came as a surprise, not to say a shock." She laughed. "But in a funny way, it's a relief. I never fit into the family I grew up in, and I always felt they resented me and disapproved of me, and I didn't know why. Now I know. It wasn't really about me, it was their disapproval of the circumstances of my birth, not something I'd done wrong, which was how I felt. I don't think my mother ever got over it. It takes a lot to banish your own child and declare her dead. It broke my mother's heart never seeing me again. Our nanny used to send her photographs of me, which was how I made the connection when I saw them." She told them about Marguerite's safe deposit box then, and the jewelry, Philip doing the appraisal, by sheer coincidence, and Fiona's admission to her of what had really happened so long ago. "I would never have known about your uncle, my father, if I hadn't gone to see her and she hadn't told me. She was surprised I never figured it out, but my grandparents hid it well. Even my birth certificate was falsified and showed them as my parents. They went to great lengths to conceal the truth from me. I wonder if they had any contact with your grandparents after I was born, or if they never spoke again. Apparently, none of them wanted my parents to get married, and they were certainly very young, and it would have been a terrible scandal among the people they knew in those days."
"I never heard a word of it," Tom admitted over coffee and dessert. "My father even denied it when I asked him about you. It must have really shocked him to have it surface after so many years. Nobody ever mentioned Tommy having a child."
"You'd think someone would have been curious about me, but I guess it was just too upsetting to face it, so no one did. I would have liked to meet your grandparents."
But meeting Walter would be enough. She hoped he would be well enough to see her during her brief stay. Tom had said during dinner that he was having a rough spell. He didn't tell her that his father was refusing to see her and behaving like an angry child. He didn't want to hurt her feelings after the effort she'd made to come out and meet them. He was glad she had. They shared many common interests and were as open-minded as she was, despite their conservative appearance. They were bright and fun and interested in the world, in sharp contrast to Winnie, whom she'd grown up with and was so shut down and negative about so many things. Angie and Tom really seemed to enjoy life, just as Valerie did. She stayed at their house later than she'd planned and got back to the hotel after midnight, after promising to come back and see them again the next day. Angie had offered to take her to the local antique shops the next morning, and Tom wanted to show her his architectural office, which he was very proud of, and they took her out to lunch afterward. He obviously had a very successful practice and had built many of the houses in Montecito that they drove by. And during lunch, Tom asked her what was going to happen to her mother's jewels. She had told them about the Christie's auction in May and explained that she was currently waiting for results of the DNA test, which would confirm her as Marguerite's heir.
"It's more of a formality. I'd love to see the jewelry," Angie commented, and Valerie promised to send her the catalog of the sale.
They had organized a dinner with their children that evening, and even their son from Los Angeles came. They had gone all out, and Valerie was touched by the warm reception she got from everyone. It was remarkable, considering that she was the long-lost, illegitimate cousin and niece that no one had even known about. And now they all acted as though they had been waiting for a lifetime to meet her, except for her Uncle Walter, who was continuing to refuse to leave his room. All his grandchildren asked where he was when they arrived.
"Grandpa's not feeling well. He's resting in his room," Tom said simply.
Two of them went to see him, and Tom's oldest son came out and commented to his father.
"Wow, Grandpa's in one hell of a foul mood. What happened?"
He had never seen him that way before.
"It's a long story."
He didn't want to explain now, in case Valerie overheard him and was hurt by her uncle's refusal to meet her. He had lost hope of his father becoming reasonable by then. Valerie thought Angie and Tom's children were wonderful. The conversation was lively and fun at dinner, and she was sorry Philip hadn't come. But she hoped to come back again, and promised to bring him next time. She wanted them to meet him, too. They were talking and laughing after dinner, as Tom served champagne to everyone, and he was just toasting his newfound cousin when they were suddenly aware of another presence, and all heads turned to see Walter wheel himself into the room with a stern expression.
"What's all the noise out here? You people could wake the dead."
He was a dignified-looking, very old man, and he wore a proper suit with a white shirt and tie, and had put on his shoes, and Tom knew it had cost enormous effort to do so by himself, and he was proud of him as he handed him a glass of champagne.
"You look terrific, Dad," he said gently, as Valerie smiled at him from across the room, and then walked toward him respectfully, and extended her hand.
His disapproval of her was plain on his face, but it didn't deter her. She had been waiting to meet him.
"It's a great honor to meet you, sir," she said softly, and he hesitated for a long moment. Then he shook her hand as his eyes bored into hers. He wanted to dislike her as much as he had hoped to, but he found he couldn't, and tears filled his eyes as he looked at her, and then he finally spoke.
"You look so much like your dad, even at your age."
And then he smiled. She took out the photograph of Philip to show him then, and he stared at it hungrily.
"I guess that's how Tommy would have looked at his age."
She sat down next to him, and they talked for a long time as he slowly mellowed in the face of her gentleness and grace.
"Your mother was a very pretty girl," he admitted, "and I know she loved him. He loved her, too. I always worried about what would happen between them. It was a flame that was just too bright, and I was afraid they'd get burned. I was at Princeton when it all happened, and when I came home, all hell had broken loose, and she was already gone. And then Pearl Harbor, and we were both drafted. I shipped out before he did. He was desperate about you. He didn't want Marguerite to give you up. He wanted to marry her when he came back, but he never did. And I never knew what happened to you after that. They told my parents that you'd been given up, and that was the end of it. My mother didn't believe them, and thought there was something suspicious about it, but I think they didn't want to know. I think because Tommy died. They wanted to find you after you were born, but it was all too difficult then. It was easier to just let it go. We never spoke of it again, and then we heard that your mother died, and the whole story died with her. It was a chapter that was closed."
He stared at her in amazement.
"And now, here you are."
He looked at her sternly for a long moment.
"You took a long time to show up."
"I'm sorry about that. I didn't know any of it either. They never told me anything. I just found out a few weeks ago. Too late to meet my mother, sadly. She died last year before I knew. We never saw each other again after she left. I was only a few months old."
"She was a beautiful girl," he said again.
Valerie didn't tell him that she had married Umberto. He didn't need to know, and it was a lot for him to absorb. It brought up all his sadness at losing his brother, although he seemed very interested in her son and wanted to know more about him. And she told him she was an artist, and he had Valerie wheel him into his room so he could show her some of her father's paintings, and they were very good. Walter was tired then, and said he was going to rest for a while. The young people were making too much noise, and it had been a big evening for him.
"Will I see you tomorrow?"
he asked her with anxious eyes.
"If you'd like to. I'm not going back to New York till tomorrow night, and I'll be back again."
"Bring your son next time. I want to meet him. He looks like a fine boy."
"He is. I think you'd like him."
He nodded as he gazed at her.
"I'm sorry they made such a botch of it for you," he said gruffly. "You're a good woman. She probably was, too. It sounds like she had a hard life if she never saw you again, and they said she was dead. I hope she was all right in the end."
"I hope so, too,"
Valerie said softly, and he nodded and patted her hand. and before she left his room, she leaned down and gently kissed his cheek, and she saw that there were tears in his eyes, but he was smiling when she left. She went back to the others, and they talked for a while. Angie and Tom's youngest daughter played the piano, and they all sang, and it was late again when she left. Valerie invited them all to brunch at the Biltmore the next day, and afterward she went to visit with Walter. He showed her all of Tommy's drawings and paintings and photographs of them as children and young boys. He told her stories about her father that made her laugh, and by the end of the day she felt as though she had met her father as well as her uncle and cousins. He gave her a photograph of Tommy to take with her.